Let's state your name, rank, and serial number.
Hi, I'm Steve Weitz. I'm from Big Sur, a friend of Bruce's.
And we're going to recap this wonderful history of Next. And you started in Next. It was your first machine, right, in a sense?
Pretty much the first one that I really got interested in. I was using a PC laptop to write my theses in grad school, and I kind of hit a wall when I was, you know, working on the field that I was interested in. But I was at the University of Illinois at Urbana in the early 90s, and they had, as it turned out, you know, the only sort of higher-powered workstations the unwashed could go get were these several labs full of Next computers. And I remember when I was thinking, it's like, you know, I'm interested in this, you know, 3D stuff and this other things that I'm hearing about that sound really interesting, but I don't have the computer chops to do stuff. So, and a friend said, well, why don't you go check out these Next machines? I mean, because they do all this cool stuff, but they're kind of easy to digest. Well, and you know, this is the way computers should work. Now I get it. And I wound up, you know, dropping out of grad school for other reasons, but hocking my truck and buying, you know, a very nice, you know, high-end Next workstation used, and kind of just dove into it head first and wound up using that machine on one of the very first web publications, a magazine called Melvin. It was started by a couple of guys who had the franchise for The Onion in Urbana, Champaign.
And we have, of course, somewhere in here, the original version of Mosaic for the Next, but this is the Spyglass commercialized version right here.
Yep, actually a little product literature picked up, I think, at some trade show back in the earlier mid-90s, but mm-hmm. it showing one of the first commercial web browsers available.
Yeah, because, of course, you know that this browser was born on the Next. Actually, and you know what, this is a Windows 3.1 version of Mosaic. Because, of course, Mosaic was born on the Next Cube in Tim Berners-Lee's... I guess Mark Andreessen wrote a browser for the Next Cube or Slab, we don't know, at Champaign-Urbana.
Could very well have been using one of the machines that I occasionally sat down and worked at. And it was a revelation. It was very interesting. I came in 93, which is the year that Next stopped making hardware, so it was sort of discovering the greatest thing since sliced bread after the circus had just left.
Yeah.
But, you know, being a sucker for lost causes, I hung in there throughout most of the 90s and actually, you know, earned my bread with this machine, because there really, you know, not long thereafter, you know, there were ways of setting up the Mac to run a little web server on the computer you were using or mm-hmm. on the network mm-hmm. so that you, when you were building a website, you were doing your graphics in Photoshop or what have you, that you could set it up, lay out your HTML text, and hit the web page and actually see what it was looking and seeing your changes. It was hard to do that if you were kind of a small operation in 1994, mm-hmm. for example, when I first started doing it. To try to put together like a 30-page magazine where, you know, other people were writing it, but you were doing a lot of the graphics and doing all of the HTML and stuff, to have a Unix-based workstation that not only had killer graphics,
reliable, multi-threaded,
could and actually had a running web server on it where I could like do these, you know, very nice high-color, you know, graphics and stuff, compress them, put it on there, and look at the page and be able to deliver by a deadline, was really something, and I.
It was truly a bread and butter machine. They're beautifully built with the gold connectors, and
they were. There were, you know, that kind of legendary fanaticism of Steve's, you know, producing what is really arguably one of the most beautiful personal computers ever mm-hmm. built, mm-hmm. the Duesenberg of computers, and priced accordingly. But in a sense, you know, the purity of the vision did capture what, you know, I mean, there are many cooks in, you know, that has produced, you know, the cake of OS X and the new Macintosh line, but something, I mean, not, I think not only Steve, but those people like, as I said, like Bertrand Soulet, you know, is behind Interface Builder, you know, Abby Tavanian behind the mock kernel.
We talked about the PERC computer being upstairs where the mock kernel started.
Where the mock kernel started.
Carnegie Mellon, yeah.
And deciding, like, this was really a good way upon which, you know, good modern, you know, foundation on which to base something you could really get a lot of stuff done, like editing movies and dragging and dropping things at the same time.
So there was there this, we heard rumors earlier about this rumored real-time system that in about 1990 they were trying to crank out?
This is really interesting. Only a couple years after Next, you know, unveiled its first model computer, I think about the same time that they unveiled the Next Station slabs, as they were called, because they looked, you know, nicknamed the pizza boxes because they were about the same form factor, to update the Cube, sort of, you know, the iconic product, Next announced that they were going to offer 32-bit color on a megapixel display, mm-hmm. which in 1990 was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, that this, you know, extra board that would go in the Cube would also do real-time 30 frames per second digital video in and out off the machine. And this was a bit of a stretch because there, you know, the machines that were able to do this were, you know, at major studios and government labs. And, you know, they were
big frame buffers. I mean, big.
Huge pieces of equipment. And the idea of putting it on a desktop for 40,000, let alone, you know, 4,000 or whatever, was really kind of a stretch. It turned out that the most of the Next Dimension board, as it was called, worked marvelously. It had its own processor, an Intel i860. You could put up to 32 megabytes of RAM in addition to the 4 megabytes of VRAM. You had composite video, S video, and yet a third video option in and out of this board. But when it was shipped, it could not achieve the real, you know, the real-time video.
So people doing the silicon could never quite,
yeah,
silicon complete implementation of that.
The technology was just slightly, you know, ahead of what they could deliver at the time in 1990. A company called C-Cube, I think, was the foundry that was going to develop this hardware, you know, video compression. And the closest the engineering team was able to get with the chips that C-Cube produced at the time was a daughter board arrangement that fit into a large slot in the Next Dimension board within the Cube housing, on which this compression system was mounted. The best they could achieve in laboratory prototypes, and the card actually still exists. I believe it's for sale by a collector on the internet for some ridiculous price. But they could manage about 10 to 12 frames per second for about 5 seconds before the daughter board caught fire and the machine locked
up. You're
saying
that the stickers that
the are stickers on this board for sale are scorched because of the amount of heat that this thing just developed. So, on a downer note, Next neither acknowledged that this important critical feature that had been promised and people had paid handsomely for would not ship ever. They didn't, you know, it just, you know, they didn't change, you know, change the literature, product literature changed a little bit, but the price remained the same. But it still, nevertheless, was a remarkable achievement. And interestingly enough, about a year or so after Next ceased production of hardware, C-Cube was able to successfully deliver a chip to a company called Avid, which...
So they retained the intellectual property. And, of course, we know what happened with Avid, the greatest nonlinear editing system, you know, built, I guess, boards for the Macintosh, right, at that point.
Yes, an Avid system consisted of you started by buying the most powerful Macintosh desktop you could.
Quadra or something like that.
Quadra, the top-of-the-line Quadra, and then three or four extra boards, a lot of software, and additional disk drives and a couple of extra monitors, so that, I mean, you were looking at not like an $8,000 system. You were looking at like a $25,000 to $40,000 system by the time you were done.
Mm.
So only, you know, only grown-ups could really play with it. But for them, who previously had nothing but digital,
tape.
Analog tape,
yeah.
or film, this was a revelation. I mean, what the word processor did to writing, where you could freely, you didn't have to stop and retype a whole page, you didn't have to cut pages out and paste them together to rearrange your thoughts, you could just mix and mash, you know, and so forth. The ability to do that with visuals
mm-hmm.
became you know, really, really key thing. And one of the whole things about the next experience was, in a way, the epiphany that I had in 93 or something or other, you know, over time, I mean, throughout the, you know, the politics and foibles and, you know, hithers and thithers of, you know, the computer industry as a human endeavor, that vision was really dead on. Because mm-hmm. I think if you look at what most people use today, day in and day out, it, you know, there were other GUIs. The metaphor of the desktop and the images and so forth had been pretty well established.
Xerox PARC and the Xerox Star and all that, yeah.
Many people had tried it, but the idea to where you could fluidly and flawlessly not only have the third-party products for artists and photographers and writers that were easy to use, you had a programming framework that allowed developers to do very good things very easily and very quickly, and a keen sense that multimedia was really where it was going to be at, so it needed to be built right into the system mm-hmm. and be available from everything, so that you got used to having
the hardware, the digital signal processor, you know, all that, everything was built in.
It's kind of eerie to open up Next Mail and see what is essentially OS X Mail minus some extras,
mm-hmm.
where you could click a little pair of lips to record a voice attachment, because of course every Next computer came with a speaker and a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quite a novelty in 1990. And so it became common practice that you would just talk to your computer, record a voice, you could scan a picture, you know, I mean, there were a variety of ways.
There was 10 base to Ethernet built in everything, and
first thing is you have 10 base, you know, I mean, you know, where you just kind of expected to have kind of an Ethernet network, you'd set up a server, many applications worked on kind of a client server network. You expected, because the Objective-C and the programming kits that they provided to developers led, you know, to a very consistent and very rich environment. So that, for example, when you needed to pop up a text box for someone to enter text in, you used, you know, the text object that Next engineers had developed. Mm-hmm. So it came with tabs and boldface and supporting full rich text and everything. And even if you just needed to,
I remember starting. I had written my own interface on top of DOS that would do pull downs and windows and stuff, and we used Gem for the dialog boxes. But I remember Borland coming out with, you know, this is for Windows 3.0, 3.1, and all these widgets and all that stuff. And it was just kind of getting going in 91 that PCs could have like push buttons and kind of 3D looking interfaces, but you actually had a widget builder. But it was being done sort of haphazard on top of this non-preemptive operating system called Windows 3.x with DOS underneath. It was all completely haphazard, and you had a little bit of video media, but nothing was ever powerful enough to do anything. And the PC was growing up and would take over, but it's amazing how other more powerful visions that are now the de rigueur of today were there in 1988, 1990.
Much as I think you told me about Doug Engelbart and his work at developing the mouse, and was it he who told you, he said that like the cathode ray tube, the sort of analog pointing device, you know, that notion, and then certainly any of the metaphors that were, you know, in terms of desktop folders and mm-hmm. so forth, said all of those could have been in place in the late 40s.
Well, in fact, for graphical computing. Yeah, I think it would have been, well, his work culminated in 1967, 68 with the big demo, and he thought that by the 70s, people would be building these direct manipulation interface things with graphical look and feel. And of course, Xerox PARC took up that mission and built, you know, by the mid to late 70s, the Alto and all that environment, but it just took so long. And one of the things was, you know, the cost. The NLS system, the online system, it cost $500,000 in real time, 1965 dollars, 65, 66 dollars. This is a lot of money. This is millions of dollars and in today's dollars. And what was interesting was the Xerox PARC people computed that as soon there was a certain day in the mid 70s when for pixels on the screen, you went down below a penny a bit, a penny a pixel, so a penny a bit, because the display RAM on the Alto cost $8,000 to display a full page at 72 dpi on a portrait monitor. $8,000 was the cost for the memory in 1973. So, but they knew that that curve was going to go down, but it wasn't going to be overnight. And their idea of the basic minimum was black and white, 72 dpi, could show multiple fonts and things like that in images. That's, you know, just enough for an 8.5 by 11 size, a little bit more for the interface, and that by 1980 it would be possible to launch a commercial workstation with those properties. And that's when the Star came out. And of course, you know, doing it in commercial for Xerox meant a $13,000 workstation connected to the network and all that. Doing it in a consumer commercial meant,
was just
in 1984, much lower resolution, much smaller screen, less memory, you know, 256, 512K Mac, very bare bones machine, not print to multitasking, no, not like a Unix kernel or nothing like that. The Lisa had all that. The Lisa,
$10,000.
It was $10,000. It fell. It was slow. At $10,000, it fell victim to those economics of slower devices and costly.
To achieve the effect took inordinate resources.
It took inordinate resources. So of course, the Mac was your foothold, and then the Mac, you know, it was the inevitable curve that the PARC people saw that curve was continuing to go down, and that it would be all possible. So Steve, the Big Mac project, which I guess was initiated just before he was forced out of the company by the board, you know, in 1985. What I understand was that the Big Mac project was the kernel of the next idea, which was the Mac 2 was shipping, we're going to ship, you know, SE and all those sorts of things, and they're finally getting, I guess, the deal with Adobe on the Canon LaserWriter would finally make the Mac a viable platform. But then the Big Mac was going to have optical media, it was going to have a digital signal processor, it's going to have, you know, 32-bit or higher color large screens and all that, and that was Steve's vision. So as you point out, he left the company in 85, Next was founded in 86, and it was in 88 they had a product, which is pretty astounding, but it was because of the headwind, tailwind of the Big Mac.
Of Big Mac and Apple's research resources to kind of push that forward.
And so back to Doug Engelbart, I mean, Doug was certainly very optimistic that he would do this incredible demo and that suddenly the world would shape that way. And Doug told me, he said, I thought it would happen in a few years. I didn't think it would take 25 or 30 years. But it turns out we had kind of nice discussion because we did back-to-back sessions at Xerox PARC. One, he came to my session on avatars, for example, because that avatars, in a sense, were the full embodiment of his vision because it represented humans in real time and graphical world. Sometimes 3D was all real time, and the augmented intelligence being yourself in a virtual world. And one of the things that Doug said that I concurred with was that he said it was really a sociological issue. The fact is, in the 68 demo, he was, and this is well documented, he always thought that, you know, people would become knowledge workers, that everyone put in front of that screen and become knowledge workers. They would write their own documents. They would manage their own information. But in corporate America, it was set up around a World War II military model where corporate America was, like, no, you had lines of control, and you had executives that had typing pools and secretaries and executive assistants, and people went to retrieve information for you, and they're all down the chain. They were human servers. And that it wasn't until the 80s when the massive middle management downsizing occurred that cut the head off. They basically cut all of that level out that it was sociologically possible to have a manager typing, a man typing. And Peter McCullough, who was the Xerox CEO in the 60s, who founded PARC, Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and he founded it, and he gave it the mission, which was an architecture for information. Great mission statement, right? I mean, and they did it. They achieved it. And around 1980 or so, he came to PARC on many visits. He'd seen all the stuff before, and John Warnock took him on, you know, founder of Adobe, took him on a tour of PARC. And John told me this later. It was really interesting. Actually, Bob Flagel is another PARC guy who invented Doodle, the first paint program on the Alto. He said John was taking Peter around PARC, and he saw the stuff, all these people using the Altos to send email and, you know, open up Windows and compose documents, do music, everything, you know, paint, graphics, worms walking around and stuff. And at the end of the tour, John said, "Well, Peter, what did you see? You know, what most interested you?" And Peter turned to John and said, "Seeing so many men typing." And John realized that for the first time, this is why Xerox doesn't get it. Because you have a guy there who, the only thing he sees is the man's hands typing. And he doesn't understand why men are typing. Because he's from that old school, right? And why isn't there a secretarial pool? Why are these men typing? So all this time, Peter McCullough, head of Xerox, whatever, didn't understand what was going on the screen. He never looked at the screen. He wasn't following what was going on the screen. He never understood. He never grokked it in science fiction terms.
Mm-hmm.
And then the epiphany appeared to John Warnock that they're never going to get it. And so he went and got his friend Chuck Geschke. I don't know exactly how this happened, but they had this final meeting with Peter McCullough where they had been presenting to him, there's going to be Interpress, which is going to be a language to take documents to render in between screens and edit and save and edit on another computer and save and come back. And then there's Press, which is what it's converted into, goes through the raster image processor and it gets printed. And this is the whole thing, and Xerox has invented this. You know, is in the process of doing this, and will own the document business, which is what Xerox was. And this is what you have to do. You have to invest in this. You have to have specialized computers that you build that will service print service bureaus, but also compose documents for government and big archives of documents, portable documents, all this sort of stuff. This is like in 81 or so. And Peter McCullough was like getting a little frustrated because it was like more than he could and he's turned to John and Chuck and said, "You know, if you guys are so excited about all this, you should leave Xerox and start your own company." And so that was, yeah, oh my God, right? So that the day these guys got this, like, we were just told by our CEO that we can go out from the research lab, take all this proprietary ideas and start our own company. We're out of here. So Adobe was born in 82. And they initially were doing the vision that they had promoted, which is to make their own computer that could do documents render on the screen and all that, support print service bureaus and have their own raster image process. And then one day, Steve Jobs and John Sculley walk in the door and say, "No, you're not going to do any of that. You're going to build for us a mechanism to get PostScript, which was directly a derivative of Interpress and Press from Xerox, only architected a little differently, and we're going to have you guys support this machine called the Macintosh because it's the machine of the future. Don't do your own computers. That's bullshit. You got to get us the connection between this machine and the Canon laser writer, which we have a deal with over here. It's going to have a 68,000 in it, but we need somebody to make the code and make the rip to make a page go out in reasonable time, and it has to be partially rendered on the Mac and partially rendered on the printer." And John and Chuck were smart enough to say, to look Steve Jobs in the eye, and John Sculley looked like a real corporate guy, say, "All right, we believe you. We're gonna, you know, we'll do what you want." And Adobe then got its foothold. So it's just a fascinating. So the Doug Engelbart, it's how it all ties together. This is why I'm so interested in this project, because you can read this in all in history books and everything, but the whole thread you can't read in one book.
Uh-huh.
And why I've focused on getting all the hardware, all the documentation, interviewing the people, talking to people like you about how does Next fit in, display PostScript, right?
Yes.
So as the processors get faster and faster and the memory goes down, and now suddenly you can render real time PostScript to the screen, and then the font wars were going on with type, TrueType versus Adobe's font formats and stuff like that. And then the real-time rendering of 3D,
Yep.
which was starting, which led to virtual worlds and avatars and stuff, which I, you know, lived deeply in the mid to late 90s.
And when you were in, there was another kind of diaspora in that the Mac at the Mac, Apple would had a big chunk of the creative and development size, but there was a limit to what you could do. The Avid system was almost too much. I mean, it was really a workstation system, starting with a stock Mac and then adding all this stuff and
Yeah,
building it up to this huge
big clock
thing.
machine, yeah.
Quietly on the side, one of the workstation makers, started by Ed Clark, who was a whiz at graphics, named Silicon Graphics, and got a bunch of developed quietly developed a team and an image, and they kind of came across a little bit like the Apple of the workstation industry. And they bought their own chip foundry, so they had their own chip architecture, their own version of Unix, their own thing, but they had the design on the GPUs, the graphics
Graphics
processing
processing
units.
units, yeah.
And as they got better and better at it, was about the same time as the very theory and practice of 3D graphics was being developed and tested.
Yeah, with
People like Ed Catmull at Pixar, Jim Blinn now at Microsoft,
and you had
coming
some
up
of
with
the
that
early representation languages.
that would shading languages.
Inventor then became Open Inventor. Yeah.
Yes, and you had these sort of expressions. Well, so it's sort of more or less traditional workstation company with some pizzazz, dealing in graphics, well, engineers and architects, and there's a great many things for graphics. But because Silicon Graphics, based in the Bay Area, their biggest client was Industrial Light and Magic.
Okay, where I just did a talk, which you couldn't have come to because it was
I
closed, but the other one was open.
And Pixar began as Sprocket Systems, George Lucas's,
I've got this wonderful book
digital.
called The Droid Maker, which is a history of Lucas, written by Michael Rubin down, who's
Oh,
now,
really?
yeah, it's really ex it's the best book on Lucas and the beginnings of Pixar and everything.
That if you can kind of see this stew, this milieu of where these guys came out. Well, Silicon Graphics, I mean, they use lots of Macs for Photoshop and stuff, but the SGI equipment and their stuff was the linchpin of the special effects and digital effects industry. It was born, and
Now, of
it.
course, you mentioned that RenderMan via Pixar had a version that ran on the next cube,
Yes.
and that was their actual render. There wasn't hardware, but it was a software. It
It
was
was.
built into
It it it.
Next or Next OS, Next Step.
What happened was that as when Pixar was spun off, basically Steve Jobs bought Pixar from George Lucas and they spun it off. They were over in Point Richmond. They actually they had a few things. They had a product. They had RenderMan, a renderer and a shading language, a package of things to do incredible photorealistic imagery of the kind nobody had ever really seen before. And to demonstrate what kind of
We saw that thing with the bee.
the bee,
The
the little
bee talking to it's, and then there was Luxo Jr. and
Luxo Jr. and the Unison. I mean, these were extraordinary films, and every time they would make one of these kind of, okay, how can we, this is very analogous because John Lasseter's, from Disney, they were up on their history that says, here we are in like 1915, and Winsor McCay is beginning to figure out how to make animations, and people are playing with this medium. And so every one of their little films was an exercise, like, well, water's really hard, so we'll do rain, and so forth. So while they're doing this, they're starting to use SGI workstations because across.
By the way, here's an aside, and I'll tell you that and I'll change the batteries. But the aside is about 78, 79. Lauren Carpenter and the gang were eating out somewhere, and they took out, and they sort of in the back of a napkin to think of, said, how long will it take us to make a full-length feature film that's all 3D graphics effects? And they worked out how much memory. It was very much like you talked about the megapixel display going, how much memory, how much disk, how much rendering time and everything. And they said, we're going to be in our 50s. This is going to take 20 years minimum at the current development rate. And so when you look at Toy Story, one of the reasons they took all these shortcuts to get there, because the guys went from Lucas to Pixar, and they had this vision of making a full-length film. But Pixar, Toy Story is like 70 minutes or something. It's pretty darn short. So that was one big shortcut. Not 2 hours, right?
We could save 20 minutes where you don't have to render
it. And there was all this shortcuts in RenderMan and stuff that they barely made it. It was 94, I think, 95. Yeah. I was like, they did it. But it was darn close to 20 years from when they did that back of the envelope calculation.
They kind of realized it's going to be...
It is a significant wait time. It's like Doug Engelbart, that's the wait time between when his vision would become reality, because you're always optimistic. But these guys did the numbers and went, uh-oh, we got to stick at this a long time.
I better watch my cholesterol. I want to be alive.
I want to be alive because I've now realized it's a lifetime project.
That
now let me change the batteries.
That whole concept should be wrapped.